Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
following disclaimer.
Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very bluntly ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do where they're similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless, and it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedies and the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, if we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are much important, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the rules of civil procedure. Better known to some as American jurisprudence or ANJUR, the rules of civil procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on in virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course. So it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Those of these items are very affordably priced. The jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of Your Remedies in the Law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedies in the Law. And Your Remedies in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that all together make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at YourRemediesInTheLaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then I will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you get to a point where it will ask you what are your hot points interested in. This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights, anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social network. Though nothing like a social network. It's very custom, it's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think that they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be a tremendous amount of help to you. Maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do where I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. And then for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to the point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. You're over the road. You don't want to deal with the call process. Maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password. Therefore, you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button. Fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night, the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you'll get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, so winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make if your remedy is in the law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at your remedy is in the law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that, honestly, most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. Can we make those introductions? Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best, and believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen, and when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. And we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not if your remedy is in the law anyway. Of course, when you file board and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, thank you so very, very much for that disclaimer. We appreciate you, the time you put into it. Tonight, we're going to talk about two separate subjects. When I say we, John is going to talk about two separate subjects that are interrelated for the purpose of tonight's call. One subject is one of my favorites, the Second Amendment. And the other subject is a conversation that Brother John had just yesterday with a person who is now personal to John in the State Department of the United States. When I say personal to John, he knows his name, knows his phone number, reaches out, communicates, works with him like no normal business people would do. So without further ado, it's going to be my pleasure to sit back tonight and listen to Brother John share with us these two subjects and how they work together. And maybe, just maybe, he will share with you an out-of-the-blue call that he received, I believe it was yesterday, that where he was invited to appear telephonically with a court, having no knowledge that it was coming up. So, and this all marries together. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn this call over to Brother John, and let's hear what the man has to say.
Good evening, Michael and Martin. Thank you both for a kind and gracious introduction. last Friday, I spent pretty much most of the day on the phone with the State Department trying to follow up on what I thought was a lot of deaf ears and on the topic of 8 U.S.C. 1502. And then yesterday morning, I spent an unbelievable amount of time on the phone with the State Department as well. And late mid morning, I was on hold with the State Department, and all of a sudden, I had a call beeping in, and I thought, well, that was kind of interesting, and it looked vaguely familiar. And so what I did was I went ahead and I was on hold on the other line with the State Department, and I went ahead and took the call. And amidst everything, some of you may remember that we talked about a gentleman that we'd been working with at the State Department on the 1502, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, he's the one that told us that there was not enough traffic on that particular activity to warrant a regular employee when they only had a few inquiries a year. And to that end, I also had mentioned to every one of you that he had contracted COVID-19 and was out on a medical leave, and he was out over 2 months, almost 2.5 months. Hang on just a second, I've got a dry throat.
While you're doing that, John, let me check with a first-time caller here from San Marcos, California. Phone number ending in 3698. I'm Michael Edwards. Would you care to introduce yourself? Welcome to the call and share how you heard about us.
Hi, it's Ron. I'm on a different phone now. My other phone tanked, so I've been following for a while.
Yeah, okay. Thank you, Ron. Appreciate you.
Okay. Well, I decided to take the other call, and this was this gentleman that we had talked about, and he says, hey, look, I guess you've been trying to get a hold of me. He says, I would love to help you with your 8 U.S.C. 1502 filings and requirements. However, while I was out on medical leave, they replaced me in my existing department, and to that end, they I no longer work in that department, and I no longer handle any of those even vaguely like those requests. And I says, well, that's frustrating. How do we, you know, before, you know, there wasn't really anybody that actually handled them, but now there's, you know, now there's nobody. He goes, well, he says, maybe, maybe so. He says, I need to, he says, I tell you what, how about if we, if I see if I can introduce you to somebody that would know? And for those of you who are not familiar with 8 U.S.C. 1502, it's a certificate of nationality issued by the Secretary of State for a person not, I repeat, not a naturalized citizen in the United States for use in proceedings of a foreign state. In a moment, I'm going to ask Mr. Edwards to give us the definition of a foreign state based on something that occurred during the entry of one of the last states of the Union here. But I'm going to read this to you, a really short statute. The Secretary of State has authorized to issue at his discretion, in accordance with the rules and regulations prescribed by him, a certificate of nationality for any person not a naturalized citizen of the United States who presents satisfactory evidence that he is an American national. Did everybody get that? American national. And that such certificate is needed for use in judicial or administrative proceedings in a foreign state. There's that term again, foreign state. Such certificate should be issued solely for use in the case in which it was issued and shall be transmitted by the Secretary of State through the appropriate official channels to the judicial or administrative office of the foreign state, there it is again, in which it's to be used. And for those of you who have gotten your status updated or corrected in the computer with and through GW, this is what would apply to you. Now, Michael Edwards, could you please share the definition of foreign state?
A foreign state would be any government foreign to the United States. With specificity in this reference, you're dealing with the states of America united in perpetual union individually being foreign to what the states of America created, being the United States. So in this application, when the United States is speaking, we're speaking of a foreign state, which and also is its creator, the states of America, united in perpetual union.
And what document was, what was one of the most recent prominent, but what was one of the prominent documents that that definition was used in? With regards to Seward's Folly.
Alaska. Oh, okay. You're talking about introducing Alaska as well as Hawaii into the Union States. Alaska and Hawaii were territories of the United States, just like Puerto Rico. And when they translated from being territories into statehood, i.e. joining not the United States, but rather joining the states of America in perpetual union, it was required for the Congress to make provision to pay the finances of a judge to adjudicate this translation from territory to statehood. And in the language of the document that authorized the payment of this judge, they referred to the Alaska and Hawaii as a country, not a state, a country, because every one of the several states in perpetual union, the states of America, quote, states of America, end quote, that's a term to remember, are individual, unique countries. They have their own constitutions, their own guaranteed Republican form of government, etc. And that's where that phrase came in, to being alien to.
Thank you, Michael. Well,
you're welcome.
An individual that's an American national and not a citizen of the federal government, Washington, D.C., 10 miles square, Guam, Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, and the other territories held possessions, and not a citizen of the corporation, is a member of, or is a, that domiciles in one of the 50 states, they're American nationals. And there are certain things that apply, including the fact that you cannot be charged with a victimless crime. The basis of common law is that to be charged with a crime, you have to have an injured party with justiciable standing to file, meaning that they do qualify with the capacity to file a complaint, and they have to file a verified complaint, meaning that they're not only willing to not only have been injured, but they're willing to complain and say, look, Mr. Doe hit me with his bicycle, broke my leg, and I suffered these injuries and this damages, and I am filing a complaint against him. When somebody like that files a complaint, that's called a verified complaint. When they sign that and swear and testify to that, then you can be charged. A classic common example of a non-injury complaint is when, like a traffic officer cites you for failure to stop at a red stop sign. There's especially when there's nobody there, there isn't an injured party. Without an injured party, they can't legally stop you there. Now, does everybody that's an American national fight every single complaint like that when they get a complaint that says they made a California stop at a stop sign, they rolled right around it and never came to a complete stop? No. Most people don't. And it says, there's an old saying, it says, it's to a wise man's glory to overlook an offense. Sometimes failure to stop, to go ahead and fight it, you know, you can fight it, but just the time it takes in traffic court to go down there, by the time you finally get to the judge, you know, Your Honor, you're ready to make a motion. Your Honor, can I have my sentence commuted to time served for waiting in the clerk's line? You know, because you have to spend so much of your day, so much of your time involved in that sometimes taking a deferred adjudication or traffic school or something is so much easier than having the matter set for trial and not only appearing for your arraignment, but having to appear for your hearing, that It's cheaper and easier to actually just go to a traffic school on a Saturday and just and take care of it and blow it off, and it doesn't go on your record. But I had this gentleman call up, and he missed everything. He says, "Wait a minute, I know who. I need to introduce you to somebody." So he did a three-way call, and we got the gentleman's voicemail, and the gentleman he explained him who he was to the person we were calling. He explained who I was, and said that we needed some certificates of nationality issued from the Secretary of State. He said, and then he asked me to give my full name and information. And he says, if you have any questions about this, call me. But I'd prefer that you call him. He needs a letter at this time. And there's about four or six people that he has that have immediate need for the letter. And they've been trying to get one for quite a while, especially for some judicial proceedings that are in process. So when we finished up the call, this gentleman, he thanked me for not dropping the subject, but it was very kind of him that he called clean out of the blue after he had got out of the hospital, and this was his Monday was his second day back, Friday was his first day back, and I had kind of given up on trying to get a hold of him, but all of a sudden he indicated that we're going to try to see if we can get something going for getting the certificates of nationality issued. So for those of you who have been, been working on that, he said that while he was out, that quite a few requests had come in, but he had no idea how they were dispositioned, et cetera. They were, the letters had come in, and so we're going to have probably, he said, If you're currently getting prepared to send lend letters, hold off. He says, we're going to give you a new address, and he says a new person to send these to get this taken care of. And so he said, just hold on, and they're going to give us a new procedure. So, and he said that this gentleman told me that the person we referred to usually gets back to somebody within 48 to 72 hours, 2 to 3 days initially, but he's a very, very, very busy person. And it may take longer, but so just FYI, clean out of the blue yesterday, we had an 8 USC 1502 pop up on the radar, and it was a very, very positive issue. Now, the next issue was going to be the Second Amendment, and it's kind of a pet issue for me that I use regularly to make example with regarding a legal process for a lot of individuals, and for those of you who are not familiar with the Second Amendment, this is the quote unquote the gun rights amendment, and it's the issue where individuals claim that you have the they claim it's one of the shortest amendments to the Constitution, with the obvious exception of the Ninth Amendment, but says a well-regulated militia being necessary to secure for the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, when Ben Franklin was leaving the Second Continental Congress, where they signed the Declaration of Independence, one of the ladies, asked him, "Where's, good sir? Where have you what kind of government have you given us? And he said, a republic, if you have the temerity of character to keep it. There are individuals that talk about the right to keep bear farms only for the use of hunting or this or that. And there are some states that talk about, well, that's a more of a military, that's what the right to keep and bear the firearm was for. When this government was formed, the Declaration of Independence was very, very straightforward. And it says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they're endowed with their Creator with certain inalienable rights. And among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It says among these, indicating that it's a much larger pool of rights that those three, life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, come from. And that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Okay? It's extremely important that you realize that they're deriving their powers from the consent of the government, governed. You know, and in that late November day, in November 19th, 1862, when Abraham Lincoln finished his very short address at Gettysburg, he said, he used the term, this is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And that is literally, almost, not word for word, but intent for intent, quoting the Declaration of Independence. Now, when an individual is talking about rights and privileges, sometimes it's hard to discern which is which, and the Ninth Amendment is a very important keystone in those rights. It says, the enumeration of the Constitution of certain rights shall be not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. What that means is that the Ninth Amendment is saying that anything in the Constitution cannot be construed to take away or deem null and invalid your previous rights previously held. Now, some people say, well, wait a minute, the Constitution is the founding document of this country. No, not quite. The Declaration of Independence is superior, and its identification and enumeration that there are certain rights that were endowed by their Creator is superior to the Constitution. And to that end, those three rights that are enumerated there indicate that to exercise those rights, you also have to be qualified to earn a living to be able to support the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. So if we go over to the 16th Amendment, you ask yourself the question, who does that apply to? Because if it's a U.S. individual or an American national, they're covered under the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. So they have the right to earn a living. And if you can tax a right to the point where you can either take away the right or there are the proceeds of that right, meaning the income, and if they don't pay it, or you can take away their liberty because they didn't pay it, which basically takes away the right, then is the tax legal and properly construed, or is it erroneously construed? And I think I know how most of you would answer that question. And presently we have students that are fighting that exact question in U.S. District Court. And we've had some that have already fought it, and they've already been answered. It's been getting answered on an individual basis. But at the same time, going back to this is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, when the people don't have time, aren't capable of, don't feel safe, don't have the skill set, or just aren't able to, or just don't feel like they want to, they hire help. You know, air traffic controllers, forestry workers, longshoremen, city sanitation workers, governors, presidents, judges, sheriffs. Oh, by the way, those last four, they're not just hired help. They're temp help, and they have to reapply for their jobs regularly. And who do they reapply to? They apply to their employer. They go down to the employment office, the clerk's office. They get copies of the paperwork that they need the signatures for, and then they go out and they get job recommendations, and they get depending on what the geographical locale is or the state, etc. There's certain number of recommendations that they need from other people before they will, job references, before they will be allowed to sign up for potentially getting a job. And when they get, when it comes March, the primary election, their employers look at all the available candidates that have signed up to apply for that job as sheriff or governor or judge or president, and they take a shot at narrowing down the pool. And then in November, they take a shot at finishing hiring those individuals. The right to keep and bear firearms was never provided or set up to for hunting or for food, etc. Well, those things are important, but it was to keep the hired help in line, and just a deterrent that everyone knew that was out there. And the comment that we sometimes trip over is that it talks, and many of you have heard the saying that the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. And Thomas Jefferson wrote that in a 1787 letter to William Stephen Smith, the son-in-law of John Adams. Okay, and so what happens is that he was indicating that, and Thomas Jefferson was making it very, very clear that the price of the freedom that had already been paid was just a down payment, and that if we wanted to keep that freedom, those that would encroach upon it, like ravenous wolves, were ready to pounce and ready to steal away the liberty that had been provided to us by our forefathers. And to support that the right to keep and bear arms had nothing to do with hunting or recreational sports. It was there as a deterrent to the hired help to keep them from misbehaving. When I was actually on a Zoom call one time, when one lady, I was on a Zoom court call, and I was on there just before this student that I was there to appear with, amicus curiae. One lady says, "Look, Your Honor, if you're not going to abide by the Constitution and by the highest law of the land, and that means you can sweep my liberty and everything else I have away, what is to keep me or any other person that hears about your judgment today from just erasing what they appear, what appears to them in their mind to be a problem, you know, by shooting you. And at the time, this lady, I thought she was kind of brassy. She was 67 years old, I later learned. But she had a lot of brass. And the bailiff immediately, out of the corner, you know, of the camera, you could see him run over, and he grabs her. And the judge says, no, let her go. And he says, she's right. She says, if people hear about the fact that justice is not available in this court, why are they even going to come into the court? And these are the words of the judge. He says, ma'am, thank you for your temerity of character. I'm going to reverse the decision I just made. And you're right, it is unconstitutional, and now I'm going to be in concert with the Constitution. Nobody likes to see a 67-year-old lady getting her arms broken by a images of getting her arms broken by a bailiff for something that's illegal, unconstitutional, unlawful, you know, in court, on the evening news, that is, and on the on YouTube. That doesn't go over very well. I have heard of individuals, in particular one young man who was 23 that said the same thing. They remanded him to custody, and he's still serving his sentence, but they are trying to figure out what the judge was shot in the shoulder 2 weeks after he said that, and the prosecutor was killed. This was in Colorado, they don't know if they were connected. They don't know if it was whatever, but somebody decided that things were not proper there and did apparently took matter into their own hands, which and some people say, well, they took you can't take the law into your own hands. Excuse me. This is a government by the consent of the governed, of the people, by the people, and for the people. And the reason that that sheriff has the power to arrest is because that is conferred by the people, and those inalienable rights that are retained by the citizens were never surrendered or abdicated to the hired help. And, you know, and you see on TV, they talk about vigilantes taking the law in their own hands. Excuse me, the law starts with them. You guys are just hired help. You're not sovereign. You're not the top of the food chain. In fact, you're the bottom of the food chain. You know, you say, I report directly to the chief of police or directly to the sheriff. Yeah. It's like the chief of police reports to the mayor, and the mayor reports to the governor, and the governor reports to the president, and the president reports to the people. So where in the food chain is that? Well, like Michael Edwards was talking, discussing and discussing at the beginning of the call, back in August, I was in Albuquerque, of all places, and I got a call asking if I could appear on someone's behalf, a 61-year-old lady who she was waiting to pick up her granddaughter in an elementary school, and a school bus rear-ended her with her car waiting in the crosswalk, the crossing in front of the school. The crossing guard observed a black plastic case with the Smith & Wesson logo on it with a padlock on it. When the trunk was damaged and opened, that lady was she was arrested and charged with three felony counts. They had three felony grand jury indictments, and somebody had given her my phone number, and the day before her court hearing, she had given me a call. Well, I had never met her, et cetera. Turns out that someone else in the jail, she was denied bail, passed along my phone number. And the next day, the judge was doing the roll call and says, okay, and who are you, sir? And unmuted me off the Zoom. And I says, my name's Mr. So-and-so, and I was here on behalf of the defendant. Well, actually, that's not quite true. I'm here amicus curiae on behalf of the court. He says, wait a minute. This is a felony criminal charge. How can you be friend of the court in this? And I asked, would it be to the court's consideration and appreciation if there was something that could sweep away the judge's 26 years, 7 months, 2 weeks, and 3 days of tenure? And the judge interrupted me. He says, how do you know that? I says, know what? You know? And he says, about my tenure. I says, what tenure? And judge goes, okay. He says, and if there was something that could sweep away or that could cause you to violate your oath of office and potentially leave the bench in a chargeable condition of a second-degree felony without judicial immunity, would the court be interested in hearing that? And he says, well, absolutely. And the prosecutor objected vehemently, and the judge says, I'm going to go ahead and allow this. And he says, and I says, is the court familiar with 18 U.S.C. 242? And at this one, you know, he said, yes, I am. And and I says, deprivation of rights under color of law. And he goes, well, you know, Massachusetts law is very, very strict about the unlawful possession of firearms. And I says, to that end, Your Honor, would they consider a deprivation of rights? Where in the Constitution does it exclude the right to keep and bear a firearm in that school zone, let alone your courtroom? And the prosecution immediately erupted, and the judge had to ask him to be quiet. And but the bottom line was, the judge says, I'm going to summarily dismiss all three charges against the defendant, and ma'am, you're free to go. And at that point, I asked, does that also mean that she gets the return of the gun that was illegally seized and had an illegal search and seizure, which means that that the officer and anybody else related to it can be charged with 18 U.S.C. 242, felony deprivation of rights under secondary. Oh, wait a minute. And I asked, what's the statute for wrongful arrest? And the judge says, well, Mr. Prosecutor, he says, well, there isn't one. And in the middle of that, and I says, yes, that would be kidnapping under color of law. So under 18 U.S.C. 242 or 18 U.S.C. 241, anyone that conspired to try to charge her with felony unlawful carry of a firearm or the felony in a school zone, et cetera, or felony reckless endangerment of a child. And, you know, when I was 9, 10, 11, and I went to summer school in North Dakota, there was a rack in the back of the two-room schoolhouse where the children put their 22s and their 410s and their 20 and their 12-gauge shotguns because they went hunting after school. You know, and they used to bring home rabbits. And at this juncture, would that be considered kidnapping under color of law and potential capital crime apply? And the judge says, well, Mr. Prosecutor, do you have a something to share? And he says, you know, I at this juncture, it sounds like if you dismiss, then she has nothing to prosecute you with because she has no justiciable standing. And he says, Your Honor, the state moves to dismiss. Without reservation, without any question at all, he moved to dismiss. And I was on the call 14 minutes total on the Zoom call. I used to be on a live stream every week or every other week for quite a long time. Called on, it was on Thursday mornings. Called But Thy Digress. It's on the Patriot Soapbox live stream, and they may have one or two viewers. But something interesting happened today. I was in the process of helping a student prepare for a filing for tomorrow in U.S. District Court, and I was working with the student, and I got a phone call, and the phone call was from the clerk of a court, and she says, this is so-and-so with such-and-such a court located in this town in this state. It was actually Massachusetts. And I says, and the judge wants to speak with me? She says, yes, it's in open court right now. And I says, okay. She says, this is, you know, and she asked me to confirm my name, and I did. And he says, I've been asked to depose you on behalf of the defendant here regarding a firearms charge. She had an automatic weapon in her trunk in a sealed case with a suppressor. Turns out it was an MP5, a German 9mm, and she was charged with four felony grand jury indictments that included illegal, NFA firearm, illegal suppressor, illegal automatic weapon, unlawful carry in a school zone, and felony reckless child endangerment. And I says, well, Your Honor, at this juncture, I would have to say, number one, is the court familiar with 18 U.S.C. 242, deprivation of rights under color of law? And he says, I am kind of familiar with that. And I says, would it be adverse for the clerk to quick look that up? And he says, she's already looked it up, and it's printing on my printer on my desk right now. I was on the phone. I was not on a video call. And he says, I says, where in the Constitution is it excluded her right to keep and bear a firearm, even if it's automatic weapon and it's even if it has a suppressor on it or a silencer, in your that school zone, let alone your courtroom? And he says, that's no. Well, he says, you got a point there. And he says, and I says, regardless of, and I says, now who actually owns the firearm? Because in Massachusetts, nobody would be in possession or something like that unless it was registered. And so who does it come back to? Well, it comes back to her nephew who works for the Secret Service, but she had it in her car. And I says, well, regardless of whose it was, where in the Constitution is the right to keep and bear a firearm in that school zone, let alone your courtroom? And he says, you have a good point. And I says, would the prosecutor consider, and this one I ask, would the prosecutor consider dismissing the charges so that she has no justiciable standing to file under 42 U.S.C. 1983 and come against the prosecutor? And he says, I need to understand something. How do you know this lady? And I says, Your Honor, before your clerk called me, I didn't even know this woman existed. I don't know her from Adam. He says, how does she know about you? And I says, Your Honor, I asked, I says, how does she know about me? And he says, well, how does she know about you? And it turns out that the arresting officer's partner, who was out sick the day that she was arrested, recommended getting a hold of me. Turns out that they had copies of a live stream from called But I Digress that I had appeared on many, many times, and he had copies of the show. And what happened was is that after he came back from being sick, he had convinced, hold on a second, I'm getting ahead of myself. The judge says, well, I'm going to go ahead and dismiss. You've got a good point. And I never even heard the defendant's name. And I wasn't on the call 6 minutes. Okay. And it was done. Okay. I was with my wife and my son and a friend, and they overheard some of the call, and felt a little offended that I was so rude that I was talking forcefully and interrupting their conversations. And then when they found out what it was, they were a little lighter on the issue. But the phone rings again, I thought it rang. It was a text. And so I called the text back, and turns out it's the officer that convinced his partner to try to drop the charges, but the prosecutor refused to. He saw me on But I Digress, and had copies of this very discussion regarding a separate event, and felt bad for the lady, and that was her nephew's weapon and everything else. And he said that he got his partner, after seeing three of the shows of the But I Digress, withdraw the charges, but the prosecutor would not allow them to withdraw the charges, so they ended up in court. They convinced the judge to let me appear because they said, look, this is really important. We could be in very serious trouble, they told the judge. And he says, you need to see this. And that's when he had his clerk in open court, in open session. They contact me, and apparently they waited for the call to go through. They didn't take another case. He didn't call up another case while the clerk was getting a hold of me. She got a hold of me based on the information that they had, and that's how this one spread. There, in the last 18 months, there have been three events that all came out of Massachusetts where I, 48 hours before the court hearing, had no idea who these people were or ever met. It turns out that a few years back, a gentleman that I knew that was stopped for a firearms violation, he had shotguns unloaded in his trunk in locked cases. And he was arrested and detained for 74 days. While he was on vacation at Club Fed, he apparently talked about this live stream, this weekly live stream that was occurring on Thursday mornings, and he has since passed away. But he told a lot of people about it, and it began to spread. And individuals, it's amazing that when you know the truth can set you free. Clean out of the blue, without any supposition or intent on my part, individuals that I, and one of them, I never even heard their name ever. The other two, I only heard their name twice, but we ended up with a situation where the other one, it took about 35 minutes of interaction in the court. One of them, like I said, it was 16 minutes, and today, clean out of the blue, was 6 minutes. And there was a 2.5-minute call afterward where the officer thank me for appearing and appreciation. They, they're spreading the word quietly in the second worst state on deprivation of rights, Second Amendment. When you get to that place where people are unsolicitedly conveying the message that you so hard work so hard on to get out there, that they're doing it for you, then that means there may have been accidentally something done right. To that end, my time has come to a close. For those of you with questions, if you're able to refrain to the subject matter topic of the evening, thank you. If you're not, there obviously tonight there were two subject matter topics. If you're not, so be it. It's our honor and privilege to entertain any question you might have. And with that, having come to the end of my time, back to you, Martin, and back to you, Michael.
Well, thank you so very much, Brother John. Thank you. While I do this lift up here, please check your texts. Ladies and gentlemen, press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. Press star 2 on your keypad to raise your hand. Hello, Bill. For those of you on Freedom's Radio, you'll look to the center right of your monitor. Center right of your monitor, you will see a silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. It's empty. Left-click into that and type away your comment or your question. Underneath is a place to put your name, some other information, and then hit the Submit button. When you hit Submit, it pops up on my end, and then I'm happy to lend my voice to give to your comment or question, and Brother John will be answering through the call. So that's how that works. So first we start with Bill, then we go to Bruce. Go ahead, Bill.
Good evening, Michael. Good evening, John. I want to find out how you go about acquiring the certificate of nationality. You did not cover that.
Okay. If you read 8 U.S.C. 1502, and if you do a web search on it, usually the first one, one of the first two that comes up is the LII, Legal Information Institute for Cornell Law. And it's a user-funded, supported donation institute that works very hard at documenting everything, all the statutes that they can. But if you pull that up, it it explains on the that you need to apply to the administrator for the Secretary of State. And at this juncture in the past, we've had different addresses that we and different individuals that were designated to accept those. But after yesterday's call, I'm looking forward to having a new designated individual with the State Department and a new procedure. They, the individual was very, very helpful and indicated that they would try to make things, as soon as we got in touch with this other individual, that we'd try to make things as simple as possible. Until I get that, I'm going to hold off on giving any specifics because he requested that I not do any more at the moment. Until getting this new gentleman contacts me.
So the Cornell's link or information is outdated?
No. No. The Cornell only quotes the law. It what happens is that if you pull up the 8 U.S.C. 1502 information there, there's It's just as it's issued by the Secretary of State at his discretion based on the rules that he prescribes. When you have a chance to do the search and look that up, you'll understand what I mean. And hopefully sometime in the next couple of days or week or two, we'll have more information and some ABCs on how to file for that.
Okay. Thank you, John, for your contribution.
Thank you for your call tonight, Bill. Thank you.
Back to you, Mark. Just on a notice to you, I got a text from a fellow we call David R. He says, quite a remarkable call tonight. Please email me the replay link. So I just thought I'd pass that compliment on to you.
Okay.
Next is Baruka, or Bruce in English.
How are you guys?
Good, Bruce. How about yourself?
I'm great.
Go ahead, Bruce.
So your But I Digress episodes, where would we find those?
If you do a search for Patriot Soapbox, the current moderator, the previous moderator of that live stream passed away a few months ago, and now it's moderated by another gentleman. He goes by the screen name Thumper. The badass what, Uncle Sam.
what platform would that be on?
I believe it's called the Patriot Soapbox. And
is that on YouTube or some other?
Yes, it is.
All right, I found Patriot Soapbox intro on YouTube. It's like 35 seconds, but there's others there, so I'm guessing that once we find a few of those, that you said the guy's screen name was, say that again.
Thumper or Badass Uncle Sam. His actual name is Michael DeBerry.
Okay. Badass Uncle Sam. I'm sure that would be more fun to find. Okay, cool. Thank you. That's all I needed.
Take care. The Father's blessing be upon you. Good evening.
The other question that I had last night, they said, get on tomorrow night because it'll be covered in more detail, was how do you get the DA to drop these cases? And obviously you went through that, so that answered that question fully. That was great. Greatness.
An honor and a privilege.
Thank you.
Okay, back to you, Michael.
All right. Again, press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen, to raise your hand. Press star 2. I'm going to check Freedom's Radio real quickly to see if we have any Q&A going on over there. Stand by. If not, we're going to have an early evening tonight, and there's really so much to discuss. I mean, the fact that in less than 10 minutes, just a little over 5 minutes, John could address a court and have these charges dismissed, these multiple criminal charges that Union State citizens have to deal with. No, that's fantastic. So let's check again. I have to refresh here. Pardon me. Give me a moment. It's not, I got to refresh my whole screen here. My machine is running incredibly slow. So here we go. All right. Let's try this again. Press star 2 on your keypad, ladies and gentlemen. Otherwise, we're saying nighty-night. All right. Nicholas, good to see you.
Likewise. Can you hear me?
Yep, perfectly clear.
I was just going to ask, so it's my understanding that the only option for remediation if a court refuses to uphold their oath or pay attention to any of the the facts of the matter and as far as them breaking the law is to prosecute bad behavior. My question was, what's stopping them from just ignoring that as well, or where is the tipping point where something actually changes and gets done to remediate the situation?
There's a point with which individuals refuse to listen, and the prosecution that starts in certain cases the 42 U.S.C. 1983 against judiciary gets swept away with a statement that when an individual is being pursued or sued under 42 U.S.C. 1983, there's a statement in there about that if they can't be sued for a decision based on certain claims and certain issues. And so what happens is that judges, they have to live with each other and they have to work together, and they have to function under the same constituency and redress that with these others. And if somebody's going to pursue them, what happens is that usually you find yourself fighting a summary dismissal for quote, and what they do is they use a complaint called frivolous, dismissed as frivolous as the complaint. It says, and 42 U.S.C. says, except that in an action brought against a judicial officer for an act or omission taken in such officer's judicial capacity, injunctive relief shall not be granted unless a declaratory degree was violated or a declaratory relief was unavailable. For the purpose of this section, any act of Congress applicable exclusively to the District of Columbia shall be considered to be a statute of the District of Columbia. But it says, except that in any action brought against a judicial officer for an act or omission taken in such officer's judicial capacity, injunctive relief shall not be granted. Okay. And what happens is it rolls completely over the fact that what the judicial officer did was completely illegal and unconstitutional. This is where they say that judicial immunity is completely complete and full. And so what happens is that they suing the individual becomes hard to do. So what happens is that if we drop back to 18 U.S.C. 242, there is no such exception for the judiciary. And, Nicholas, in your case, that was one of the one of the things that made my heart sing, is that you're willing to prosecute under 18 U.S.C. 242, which there is no exception for judicial immunity listed under 18 U.S.C. 242. Does that help answer your question?
Yeah. So basically I understand that, if someone breaks the law, there's no exceptions, you know, if you're willing to go that direction and prosecute that, you know, people breaking the law regardless of their status.
Right. Yeah, you made a point about appealing or prosecuting criminal behavior. You've actually made that point a couple times. The first time was over a year ago. That and you're absolutely right. You prosecute criminal behavior. You don't appeal it. or let's see. Let me restate that. In the process of appealing criminal behavior, you know, in the court, you know, when they color outside the lines and they break the rules, in the process of appealing that bad behavior, you start the prosecution.
Yeah.
And actually, yesterday I spent some time with a retired member of judiciary working on your case specifically, and he's supposed to get back to me on Friday afternoon. He's retired, but he's on vacation, and he asked if I could wait till he got back from vacation to do the follow-up. I was working on your case specifically.
All right, thank you very much. That clarified it for me.
Fantastic. Thank you, Nicholas. Okay, Michael, back to you. Martin, back to you.
Anyone else? Press star 2 on your keypad. Press star 2 on your keypad while you're thinking about doing what? Pressing star 2 on your keypad. Let me go check Freedom's Radio one more time real quick, see if we have any questions pop up on this end. Nope, don't see it there. Yeah. Ooh, here we go. Brent. All right. Brent, go ahead.
Yeah, I have a bad connection here. I'm traveling, so I'm going to try to pull over so I don't lose the signal.
Now,
just a follow-up.
Brent?
A follow-up.
Brent,
yes.
Brent, when you say you're going to pull over, I hope you're not working.
No.
For those the rest of you, that's kind of an inside joke. Brent's a pilot. He drives a forklift. He piles it here, he piles it there. But to pull over to park to talk isn't quite your conventional consideration in his line of work.
Yeah, so I had a question last night, and Michael referred me to you, bring that up tonight, and that's regarding the IRS situation with preemptively preventing bad outcomes, or at least threats of bad outcomes. And I presume that's the 8 USD 1502 would be a good way to start.
Okay, that's one of the many. Okay, very, very good, Brent. That is one of the many. Present, now there's some static on the line. I don't know if that's you, but if it's you, don't change anything, just stay on the line. Okay, there's a handful of procedures that we go through, we have students that are at different stages of that. First thing we do is we establish a preponderance of evidence that the IRS does not have standing or the authority to levy taxes on you, okay? And the fact that you're an American national, and I know you've corrected your status with GW. And by the way, sometime when you have a extra moment, something was bought to the topic of discussion that I need to discuss with you when you have a moment. So sometime in the next, probably not tomorrow, but Thursday or Friday, if you get a chance, give me a call. There's a couple things we should cover on that. But the right now we have one student that's literally doing his filing preemptively against the IRS, and working on his filing all day yesterday and all day today, and he's filing first thing in the morning. And I've got a conference call set up for him right after we get done with this call. And there's a path from point A to point B where we let the court and the IRS, either we get it to the place where we have a court order, and to date we've not gotten any straight court orders. We've only got agreed to motion to dismiss that have been blessed by a court, and every one of them so far has a gag order on it, meaning that the IRS didn't want it to go to trial where they didn't have standing to succeed. And so they settled out of court before we got to the place of having a judgment. And some of those cases, most of them, the students carried the case. We were able to educate them, and they were so excited that they got into the education, and we helped them a little bit with the pleadings, and when they asked for help, well, how would you file this or how would you file that, we explained to them. This one that's filing tomorrow, he's the same way. He's been sorting everything out. He is so on point. He's so excited about getting this and getting the education that we're looking forward with bated breath to how this is going to turn out. But there's a multi-pronged approach. Now, it does take between 18 and 36 months to do the approach that we take, and what we do is we do not stop paying if they're, especially for individuals that are in good standing, current good standing. We those are the best ones, because that way neither the judiciary or the jury, if it ever should go to a jury, has nothing to say. This guy's a tax processor. He just honestly wants to know what the law is and be treated the way it's supposed to be. And so to that end, I'll tell you right now that almost everyone that that has gotten the best relief possible were not in arrears on filing their taxes.
Well, I haven't been filing because of my status.
Oh, okay. Okay, we need to, first thing we need to do, as soon as we get the new directives on the status on 8 U.S.C. 1502, we need to get with you on that and get this filed immediately. Now, when we ask for 8 U.S.C. 1502, always in the past, when we wrote the letter, it says, and could you please CC me on a courtesy copy of whatever you send to this court or to that individual? And they don't like to do that, because individuals have been taking the some have been just flat out reproducing it on their computer, and then illegally, and the secretary's signature, etc., included. So they're over three issues where, or over three individuals, separate individuals that all made wrongful, shall we say, ill considerations regarding that state, that certificate. They now only transmit the certificate through standard channels, and that, and that's what it says in the in 8 U.S.C. 1502, and they only transmit a certificate that has a raised embossed seal from the secretary on it, and so that they're they don't risk adverse, unkind, illegal attempts at duplication. Does that make any sense, Brent?
Yeah, so it goes straight to the IRS and the Department of State.
Yeah, and so I have to admit, I was getting a little beleaguered with the amount of the correspondence that I wasn't getting back when this one gentleman 2.5 months ago kind of dropped off the map, and I later found out that he was in the hospital with CV-19. That left me a little bit frustrated, and a lot of our students, because we now didn't have a path to get those requests taken care of, or at least you didn't appear to. So at this juncture, I'm hoping that shortly, within the next week or two, a couple of weeks, Brent, to have that process taken care of. And let's you and I get together, probably not tomorrow, but either Thursday or Friday, for a conference call on your topic, okay?
Okay, sounds good.
Thank you, Brent. Take care, sir.
Thank you. Have a great
All righty. Next is, welcome back, Bruce.
Hey, thanks. I meant to mention earlier, I have two contacts that are Leos. One is a retired Dallas police officer who happens to be one of my kids' father-in-law. And this guy is somewhat notorious in that he was former SWAT in Dallas, and when those officers were being sniped and killed a few years ago in downtown Dallas during a BLM protest, he was the first guy to rush in, was completely unhurt, but was one of the guys that was able to distract the shooter. And long and short of it, it worked out okay. But anyway, he is now a campus cop at a local junior college, and he does not have access to the system to be able to run a card and see if you have a record or if you're wanted or anything. The second person I talked to is an officer that is part-time at my place of business, and he's there in uniform in the local city's uniform, has a regular squad car and all that. I asked him about running somebody's card to find their status. He says, we can't do that. We'd get fired unless, you know, if I happen to pull the guy over doing 70 and a 30, then, yeah, I would run it and find out what it is. But there's no way you'd ever get a picture of it, redacted or not. We can't do that. And he was kind of spitting polish and, you know, Joe Friday about it, but at least he talked to me about it and was not familiar with our process. I said, yeah, you need to ask around about this. This could help us all. Told him some of the benefits. And he goes, that's very interesting. I'll look into it. So who knows? Maybe we'll get him on a call here soon.
Yeah. Let me come in on this, if I may, Brother John. It is very politically dangerous for any Leo to make these inquiries without justification. With justification, it's not a problem at all. But without justification, it is a great problem. So what I would do, where I'm similarly situated, having someone who I can have a beer with, if you would, I'd say, look, you're going to need to, I'm going to do this. You're going to need to pull me over. For whatever reason, you're going to put me in the back seat, okay, so that I'm in line with your monitor. And what I'd like for you to do is run this for me. You have total justification for pulling me over because I did this or that. And for your safety's sake, you have me in the back cage. I just happen to have my phone with me to make sure that I have a clear shot of your monitor. Now, having said that, before you enact whatever it is that you're going to enact, you're going to likely get the results that you want to have. That would be what I would do where I similarly situated.
Yeah, and obviously it'd have to be somebody you knew pretty well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Hmm. So, I had a former roommate that was a cop.
There you go. Cool. Anyway, that was just a comment I wanted to make that I did ask around and to no avail so far, but.
Yeah, there's a lot of challenges. There's somebody who many, many years ago, a similar situation where he was re-identified as an American national. His son used to be the head of the drug task force for Orange County, the Orange County Sheriff Department. And Rick said that he ran his father's ID many, many times. And this is before Dad got a passport card. And remember, the passport card, they drifted away from putting all the information on that mag stripe on the passport card to just having the serial number, the electronic identification serial number on there, the EISN, and so that you have to have a terminal that's approved for the data to be able to pull the data down, so that you just can't willy-nilly take a card reader. Now, Rick's father, Rich, before the fire, I had a mag stripe reader, and his California driver's license had the data on it at the time. Now the California driver's license only has your EISN on it, your electronic identification serial number. So, and you have to be at a terminal that is approved, and they can, and the administrators can disapprove that transaction, that search transaction, while you're waiting in the car. They can disapprove it so that the officer can't pull it up. It's become a teeny weeny bit of a hot potato, politically a hot potato. But the more people that slowly get their status corrected, the stronger the force will be that the data will be available, and the less they can stop it.
Well, hopefully our new contact at State can also, with just a simple inquiry or call, hopefully can give us status.
Right. That's what we're hoping for also. So
that would,
thank
that
you
would
for
solve,
your...
That would solve the entire problem.
Yes, it would. When we first started this, the information was available readily. Because there's been a movement, an inquiry to obtain the information regularly, that lack of availability has continued to propagate. So there you go. It's there may be people that are less than pleased that all of this information is getting out.
That's awesome. Thanks.
Thank you for your call. The Father's blessings be upon you. Back to you, Michael.
All righty, all righty, all righty. Next would be Jennifer Sue.
Good evening, Martin.
Good evening, young lady.
I'm just calling because I just thought this question might help everyone, although I was hoping to get a call in tonight with you after this call, so I don't know whether you want to answer it later or now. So it's just I got a letter from the court saying that
they were a little upset with you.
Yeah.
But they're a little upset with you, but they said they're not going to let your Sixth Amendment assistance talk.
Right.
We're going to keep them muted all the time.
Right.
Yeah. What overly thoughtful citizens. So, Jennifer, we've already started working on a motion with a brief to explain the difference between the 1985 Mary versus Williams case that in which the Supreme Court ruled that everybody has the right to counsel, and if they can't afford it, that one will be provided for them, and the difference between that and the Sixth Amendment, okay? So there's a big difference between the 1985 U.S. Supreme Court ruling and the Sixth Amendment right to have counsel, even if it's your aged grandmother.
Right.
You know?
Okay.
Yes, and so, yeah, we're already started working on that brief for you.
Oh, I really appreciate that. Thank you, because I'm a bit freaked out. I just don't know how I'll handle it. And do you think it also seemed like I don't have to go to the court? The whole thing is going to still be online. Is that your understanding of what she was saying?
It looks like that they are going to make a special consideration. The previous email made it very clear that everybody had to appear in person. You remember that?
Yeah. That's why. Okay. I'll just call them and make sure, because it was a bit confusing, the last email. But anyway, thanks so much, and I'll let you go now.
Thank you, and I guess we're your hearing is Friday.
Yes.
Yep, and I'm gonna see if I can get something done right away. A brief to help. I'm calling it my Free the Slaves brief, because I'm hoping that's what I'm sorry, that I know that sounds bad, but I'm hoping that that's what we can do with it. I know.
I would need to file that with the county, would I?
Well, we're going to file it. Now, it's not, because it's not a motion directly related to your case per se, but it's to the court procedures. There's a good chance that even if we file it as late as Thursday, that they will still honor it. We're going to try to put a little bit of teeth into it so that they'll be more interested in avoiding the teeth than playing the games with the Bar Association. For those of you who are not familiar with the topic that Jennifer's addressing, the topic is the judiciary don't like to allow anybody who's not a member of the bar speak in court. And it was 87 years from the time the Sixth Amendment was penned to the time that the American Bar Association was formed. And when the Sixth Amendment was penned, it had nothing to do with the bar. And at that juncture, they're trying to encourage people to utilize the commerce of law, not the technology or the business of law, but the commerce of law. And what happens is that the judiciary, et cetera, are playing a favorites game where they only let, quote-unquote, licensed attorneys appear. So that's a well, we'll see how it goes, Jennifer.
Do you know anything about the bond? Do you know anything about the bond of the judge or anything like that that you could slip in like you have with other judges?
Oh, you mean Judge Schick?
I have
somebody looking into his bond right now.
Okay, great. And also, did you see the answer they gave to the last lot of paperwork I filed?
I have not seen the opposing party's answer yet. No, I have not.
Okay. I think Michael has sent it. Should I have him send it again tonight?
I'm certain. Well, I have been in a dead sprint to the end zone on another student right now preparing to file in U.S. District Court in the morning. Let's see
okay.
here. I, the, I did see the email, you sent, well, you sent me a copy of the same email that, I received from, Judge Schick Chambers. And, you know, that, Claire,
yeah, that
sent
was
over.
That was regarding the whether you could be party to
right,
it.
Right,
I'm
right,
talking,
right.
I'm talking about
another
email.
Okay. Yes, I understand that. And I was saying that that's what I have a copy of that was received at 9:07 p.m. this evening. And, I originally received the one from Judge Schick at 11:54 a.m. So I've is it possible that you may have sent that one instead of the well?
No, I sent
if you,
the other. No, I sent the other
you,
one yesterday.
Oh, yesterday? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, if you could resend it, that would be appreciated. That way I can make certain that that I got it, okay?
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate
yep.
you.
Appreciate you very much, girl. You take care.
You too. Thank you.
Okay.
Alrighty. Last on the call tonight, and then we're going to go home, is Bill. Go ahead, Bill.
Is this Bill from Florida?
It is.
Yes. Got a quick question. Suppose someone who had a felony on their record, I know of somebody who has a felony on their record, if they went in, if they had corrected their status and they went in to buy a gun and had no real intention of buying a gun, but say they went in to check their status, would the gun shop, with the corrected status passport card, would the gun shop discover that they were an American national? And not if they had no felony on their record when they went to check that using the passport card, that would indicate probably that they were designated as an American national.
Okay. I think I see the pond you're fishing in, Bill. It's because now almost every state requires a quote unquote a yellow sheet with a background check, et cetera, to purchase a firearm. With one of the exclusive exceptions, well, is obviously the state of Texas. But there, in Texas, you can own an automatic weapon without a tax stamp. You know, you don't have to. You can build your suppressor or your silencer at home. You can build your automatic weapon at home. You can build your Glock, you know, a 80% or Glock 19 or 17 at home. Or you can build your AR-10 or AR-15 or your M-16 at home. You don't have to file any paperwork, and there's no serialization required. But at the same time, I see your point. Some states check everything on your background, and if you chose to use the passport card, could they be able to see it? Now, remember, the passport card, now the new ones only have your electronic identification number on there. That's all that's on that magstripe now. There are a few exceptions. Certain individuals that have diplomatic status, it also flags the diplomatic status that they have. But and this changes from time to time. It changed a year and a half ago last August, and 2.5 years ago last July, it changed again. What's on the back of the card. So it's on the mag stripe. But I don't know. I've never considered if the FFLs have access to the status information and if their terminals or the terminal that they go through at the ATF, because they are actually logging on to an ATF website. And it's through the ATF that they get that information. It's not that they're logging onto the NCIC database and doing the search themselves. The ATF has a very specific protocol that they go through to do your approval for yellow sheet. And so what happens is that they have everything go through them. And you, when you're an FFL, you apply for your ID and your passcode to be able to do those searches. I don't know. I'm going to look into that. I have many, many friends that are FFLs that are gunsmiths. In fact, I might have even been a Smith, Class 3 Smith up until November of 1994. I still have a handful of friends that still are card-carrying FFLs. I'll look into it.
Okay. Very well. I appreciate it.
An honor and privilege. Good to have you on the call tonight, Bill.
Thank you, John.
Take care.
All right. I want to thank everyone for joining us this evening. John, any parting words before we talk about tomorrow night's call?
He who stands for nothing will stand for anything, and he who stands for anything stands for nothing. Your employees will get away with whatever you allow them to. Many of you have heard me tell this very bad joke that actually was taken from real life, where a gentleman walked out onto his factory floor and found five gentlemen behind a large machine smoking and having coffee. And he asked them, why aren't you guys working? And one of them literally says, we didn't know you were watching. Our elected officials, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, they are going to town, to the Hill for their meetings. There are some bills right now in Congress. Tonight there's a Second Amendment that they're talking about putting a tax equivalent to over $100 on a magazine over 10 rounds, and they're talking about taxing firearms, putting a tax, a sales tax on the firearms, because they can't, too many individuals have been, it has been clarified to them that if you enact this, we will have you arrested. And there's individuals from the great state of Texas that used to support firearm restrictions. most of them because I was present when one of the U.S. senators from Texas, I was at the Republican Senatorial Convention that was in San Antonio, Texas that year, when someone during a break in the rules-making committee, and I was sitting there with Lieutenant Governor Abbott at the time, they faced him up and they says, look, you vote for this under 18 U.S.C. 241, we will have you arrested and charged with a felony. And he says, you can't do that. I'm a senator. He says, yes, I can. You're saying you can break the law and with impunity and deprive us of our rights. He says, there's nothing there. So killing you, if you got shot, and the gentleman said, if you got shot resisting arrest, you would get shot resisting arrest, and we would have a legitimate felony to try you on. Now, and with that, there has never, to my knowledge, has any U.S. senator or representative from the state of Texas ever voted in support of any of these gun bills. So for all of those who are out there, tonight was obviously a Second Amendment kind of night. Think about what you would do with the senators and representatives from your great state when you – and don't call them up because they can hang up. Go to their office. Take the time to drive over to the Capitol when they're there, or go to a fundraiser. And, you know, it's an election year and they're all holding fundraisers. But go over, shake their hands, smile, and say, look, here's a little cue card for you. It's 18 U.S.C. 241. And where in the Constitution to exclude the right to keep bear fire in a school ground or a 10-round magazine or an automatic weapon? And if you vote for this, that's a deprivation of my rights. It is my intention, unconditionally and unequivocally, to see you arrested. Stand up. Deal with your employees. And remember, that it's never easy. Thomas Jefferson made it very, very clear that the tree of liberty must be refreshed with the blood of patriots and tyrants from time to time. If we do it when it's not critical and when we don't have a Ruby Ridge or a Waco issue going, things are a lot easier and a lot less bloody to resolve. With that, it's an honor and a privilege to stand beside every single one of you serving liberty. Back to you, Michael.
All right. Thank you so very, very much. To tomorrow night, ladies and gentlemen, we will return with Wah, and I will be presenting the limited liability company. I'll have some important news to share with you that's very, very critical. We've been discussing the effect of January 1st, where limited liability companies had to report who the beneficiaries were as the managers. Well, you're going to learn and have an update even better than the last update that I shared with you. Until then, good night, everyone, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you.